conspiracy to feed people. Currently, our Sydney chapter is serving free vegan meals to absolutely anyone at Newtown Station every Thursday and Sunday. Right at the moment, our volunteer chefs are cooking up something delicious to serve at 5:30, so if you'd like to join us for a meal, anyone is welcome regardless of age, race, wealth, gender, sexual orientation, or political leaning. We do not discriminate. Anyone is welcome to come eat against the machine. Food Not Bombs operates in thousands of autonomous kitchens around the world. It has also had a role in feeding most major protest movements in the West that have opposed state violence and warfare since the 1980s. This talk will outline the importance of your personal involvement in the community mutual aid efforts around you in an age of accelerating wealth inequality, climate disasters, geopolitical conflict, digital alienation, and hunger. But before I dive in, some rules of engagement. Welcome. Izzy and I would prefer to remain anonymous. The reason for this will become clear when we get to our section on the history of state repression of Food Not Bombs. A few of that up there know me personally, love you heaps, but please shut up about it. Today my name is simply Joe, and this is simply Izzy. We will give you nothing about our personal or educational background. You'll just have to judge the value of ideas based on the quality of the information we present. This talk is going to be recorded and released as a podcast, so please be nice. That is unless Izzy and I really screw up, in which case, go at us. And then we'll just re-record it at a later date. We prefer questions to be left to the end of our talk. You're welcome to ask for clarification questions. So if we use a term that you aren't familiar with, happy to clarify that. But any commentary, additional ideas, or critiques we'd like to leave for the end of the discussion, if that sounds good. Yep, great. I'll now hand it over to Izzy, who will kick things off by explaining why we serve free food.
Yeah, so Food Not Bombs Sydney gives away free food to anyone, regardless of their financial circumstances, their ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, you name it. There are two main reasons why we give our food away for free. One is that there is so much free food around, and the other is that people can't afford to eat. So to focus on the first reason, there is so much food that goes to waste, meaning there's an incredible amount of free and edible food out there if you're willing to save it from landfill. Based on the Australian Institute of Research done in 2023, Australia throws away 7.6 million tonnes of food each year, costing households $19.3 billion, whilst food retailers make a profit of $1.2 billion from this waste, giving them very little incentive to reduce their food waste. Supermarkets also reject 20 to 40% of fruit and vegetables, meaning tons of food every year is thrown out before even making it to the shelf. According to NASA, landfill waste is one of the three largest contributors of fugitive methane emissions. Methane being one of the most potent greenhouse gases. Food waste is the cause of 58% of landfill emissions. Grabbing yourself free food from us, you are not only reducing food that was already going to go to waste in the area, but also reducing your contribution to food waste by defunding the supermarkets that fuel this enormous tide of waste. The second reason is that we are in the midst of a cost of living crisis. According to research done by Melbourne Institute, between August 2022 and February 2023, when inflation hits its highest levels in 33 years, over half, which is 53%, of surveyed Australians reported struggling to afford their basic needs. With respect to facing food challenges, such as not eating enough or reducing the level of nutritious or fresh food, those who struggle the most are at the ages of between 18 to 24, followed by those aged 25 to 34. So, fairly young. It is our contention at Food Not Bombs that the young and vulnerable in our communities are not going hungry from a lack of available food. There's heaps of food around. They're going hungry because they've been priced out of accessing food by corporate price inflation. And Joe is an economics nerd, so he'll explain further.
So while blaming food price inflation on supply shocks, supermarkets like Coles and Woolworths have made over $1 billion in profit over the past year. That is record profits for them Historically, pioneering research by the IMF has recently suggested that 50% of post-COVID inflation in the Eurozone was driven by expanding corporate profits. So that's half the inflationary shock was just profiteering, essentially, in a pure margin sense. 30% of the inflation was imported commodity costs, so that's largely attributed to the outbreak of the Ukraine war, Putin pushing up oil prices, etc., and only 20% of it was through wage inflation, and yet we are being asked to have our wages crunched down on by high interest rates in order to contain inflation. Similar studies are noticeably absent in Australia, but the very fact that wage inflation, or WPI, has not kept anywhere near the price of consumer inflation and corporate profit growth is an indication that the entities that control our food supply have used the recent crisis to enrich themselves and starve us. Back to the... That was my economics note.
So yeah, I personally don't see any of this changing as long as we continue to live in a society where major political parties on both sides of the aisle continue to receive most of their funding from corporate donors. By taking free food from us, you are making a small act of defiance, a middle finger to these big corporations and to the system itself. It may be a small act, but never doubt the impact a group of people doing good things can make. Along with being free, our membership is open to all, and Joe will explain all that.
Sure thing. So anyone from any walk of life or ideology is welcome to eat at Food Not Bombs. So, in terms of political orientation, many of us have no clear idea what an ideal society should look like, but by practicing Food Not Bombs, we begin to see the outlines of an economy based on generosity and empathy rather than fear. When we're eating for free, suddenly rejecting an economic system that is destroying the planet and increasingly forcing us to go hungry in the midst of an abundance of food no longer seems so scary. Food Not Bombs is a vegan cake in the face of the threat of starvation, which animates your working life. Hunger, homelessness, and carceral violence are threats that force us to sell our labour. Hunger is a weapon of economic control, deployed to ensure a compliant labour force and returns to shareholders, mortgagees, and landlords. Our contention is that the threat of hunger is not necessary to have a functioning economy. Perhaps we are wrong. Food Not Bombs is half an exercise in figuring that out. And half an exercise in proving that we as people are motivated by something more than profit or social clout. Almost everyone experiences the threat of food insecurity, and so everyone is welcome to participate in Food Not Bombs. Another reason for open membership is that the political hard right is very good at presenting a unified front. I mean, like, you think of Trump at the moment, half the Republicans absolutely hate the dude, but they all act like they love him. While us on the left are very good at arguing with each other, because we actually care about each other's ideas and listen to each other. So it's important, along with having stand-up arguments sometimes, that we learn how to get along and get shit done. In a Food Not Bombs kitchen, you'll find anarchists working alongside bog-standard social democrats, centrist Catholic charitable works types, which makes for some fun and weird conversations around the kitchen. We may not always agree with each other, but we all agree that no one in our community should go hungry, that genocide is bad, and by working together we can form a community around that. A community that resists a system that wants to isolate us in online bubbles of rage based on gender, race, sexual orientation, age, class, and political allegiance. Zuckerberg wants us to fight. That's how he makes his money on Facebook. But by eating with other people, that's a great way of learning to agree more than disagree on stuff. That's really important. In short, the best way to get to know your neighbours is to invite them to dinner. And Food Not Bombs is a dinner for everyone. We serve our food openly to the public multiple times a week at the Newtown train station. We eat, the unhoused eats, the community eats, and anyone who's travelling through eats. Alongside our public feasts, we also cater to political actions aimed at resisting the state and corporate violence. The only thing worse than being hungry is being politically persecuted and killed. So we feed the protests that keep our community safe and which aim to prevent our resources being spent on war, not food. Food Not Bombs is anti-hierarchical. There are no leaders in Food Not Bombs, or more accurately, everyone is a leader. All participation is absolutely voluntary, and group decisions are made via consensus. This way, recent migrants, the young, the unhoused, and other newer vulnerable people in our community have the space and power to cater to their needs. There is no key person risk as well. Anyone can do anything, making us resilient to changes in membership or potentially repressive political regimes. We operate independently in autonomous cells. No Food Not Bombs chapter has a say in what another Food Not Bombs chapter does. And anyone is free to call themselves Food Not Bombs and start their own chapter, so long as they adhere to the three principles, which Izzy will outline below.
So Food Not Bombs has three core principles, and they are that food is always free and always vegan. Each chapter is autonomous, non-hierarchical, and makes decisions via consensus. And Food Not Bombs is not a charity, rather a mutual aid and organization dedicated to non-violent social change. So I'll start off by describing the differences between mutual aid and charity, and as this is a fun, challenging concept. So the key differences between a charity and a mutual aid organization is that charities have a framework of the privileged helping the underprivileged. So while mutual aid organizations assume no such hierarchy exists, there are no hierarchies, only members of the community, and whoever receives aid one day is welcome to help give it to the next person and is actively encouraged to do so, like it's a give and take. To drill in a little deeper, let's define charities. So a charitable organization, or a charity, is an organization whose primary objectives are philanthropy and social well-being, so educational, like for educational, religious, or other activities serving the public interest or common good. However, as explained in Solidarity Not Charity by Dean Spade, who is a legal scholar and activist, charities are increasingly privatized and contracted out to the massive non-profit sector. Non-profits compete for grants to address social problems, and there are two main issues with this. One being that elite donors get to decide what strategies should be funded and then protect their money from taxation by storing it in foundations that fund their pet projects, and most of which have nothing to do with poor people. The second is that to win grants, nonprofits also seek to make themselves look successful or impactful, regardless of whether their work is actually getting to the root cause of the problem. For example, social service nonprofits will often claim they have worked with like large numbers of people, even though most of those people did not become less vulnerable or get what they actually needed from their contact with the nonprofit. Even nonprofits that do claim to address poverty are mostly run by white elites. Charities make rich people and corporations look generous, while still upholding and legitimizing the systems that concentrate wealth. Mutual aid, however, is an organizational model where voluntary, collaborative exchanges of resources and services for common benefit take place amongst community members to overcome social, economic, and political barriers to meeting common needs. So this can include physical resources like food, clothing, or medicine, as well as services like breakfast programs or education. These groups are often built for the daily needs of their communities, but mutual aid groups are also found throughout relief efforts, such as in natural disasters or pandemics like COVID-19. In fact, Food Not Bombs Sydney continued to operate during the pandemic with people cooking up food in their homes and then others helping transport that food to those who needed it. Dean Spade explains that the framework of mutual aid is significant in the context of social movements resisting capitalist and colonial domination, in which wealth and resources are extracted and concentrated, and most people can survive only by participating in various extractive relationships. So providing for one another through coordinated collective care is radical and generative. So as you can see, mutual aid projects depart from the charity model in crucial ways. Most mutual aid projects are volunteer-based and avoid the careerism, business approach, and charity model of nonprofits. Mutual aid projects strive to include lots of people rather than just a few people who have been declared experts or professionals. As Dean Spade states, if we want to provide survival support to as many people as possible, and mobilize as many people as possible for root causes change, we need to let a lot of people do the work and make decisions about the work together, rather than bottlenecking the process with hierarchies that only a few people lead. These are all very important goals, and avoiding the pitfalls of co-optation, deservingness hierarchies, saviorism, and disconnect from root cause work requires constant vigilance. A big aspect of how you can avoid hierarchies, and include people, is how you can conduct your decision making, which takes us to our next point. So, Binabam Sini strives to operate in an autonomous, horizontal, consensus decision way. So what we mean by horizontal organizing, simply put, is if hierarchies are vertical, non-hierarchical organizing is horizontal. So no one has power over anyone else, or at least that's the ideal. Horizontal decision-making structures are based on consensus, which prevents decision-making from being concentrated in one person or a small group, and that can help tasks and roles get distributed to many people. It's more effective and efficient when participants know how to raise concerns, how to propose ideas, when a decision has been made and by whom, and how to put that decision into practice. People who feel unclear about whether their opinion matters or how to be part of making decisions tend to drift away. So it's important that everyone has a chance to participate in decision making and feel co-ownership of the project, leaving them more likely to stick around and do the work. Strong structures also help bring in new people, orient them to the work, train them in skills they need to build, and give them roles they want. All of this is crucial in not only building a community that is self-sufficient and effective, but also in helping prevent individuals burning out, which is super important, due to carrying a majority of the responsibilities, which happens more often than people realize. To summarize, horizontal decision-making is important for encouraging the vulnerable members to vocalize and address their needs, encouraging wide membership and avoiding burnout, sharing skills, and as Joe mentioned, the organization being resilient to changes in membership. Okay, now for the final principle, which is veganism. So the simple reason why we serve vegan food is that using animal flesh and byproducts, like milk and eggs, when sourced from bins, has a higher health and safety risk, such as contracting diseases associated with expired meat like salmonella, which can and has caused death, which we don't want. Vegan food is also inclusive, as it's kosher, halal, sattvic, vegetarian, and pescatarian friendly, meaning anyone can eat it. Yes, even those who are self-proclaimed carnivores. And the second and more nuanced reason is that Funabom Sini wants to be consistently anti-oppression, including anti-speciesism. But before I continue, I'd like to make it very clear that when I speak about practicing anti-speciesism, I mean Funabom Sini as a collective, not on an individual level, as each person within the collective has their own various political and ethical views. I also emphasise Sini because this is not practiced in every Funabom's chapter in Australia nor around the world. Like we said earlier, what we do isn't what every Funabom's does. So what is speciesism, and therefore what does it mean to be anti-specious? And how does this fit into being consistently anti-oppression?
Sorry, I'm not understanding the anti word.
Anti-speciesism,
like...
Speciesism.
We do not discriminate value of life based on species.
Yeah. Try to think of another example. Like, it's like, you know, instead of saying you're not a racist or... So, let's begin with a tale as old as time, inspired by the words of David Libert, who is an author, activist, and professor of sociology. So it all begins with warmongering, money-hungry men in a constant state of seeking greater power and wealth, who created a violent, patriarchal societies. In this process, malicious belief systems were created, including sexism, racism, classism, and of course, speciesism. So a lot of isms. These belief systems were enforced to rationalize and normalize the horrific treatment of groups of people and other animals, their fate very heavily entwined. So the anti-speciesist action group defines speciesism as a belief of human superiority leading to the systemic oppression, exploitation, and discrimination of non-human animals. Christy Alger, in her book Five Essays for Freedom, further explains that it is this idea of moral consideration that has formed the foundational abolitionist position that veganism is not simply a consumer behavior, but rather a moral imperative. However, to be clear, veganism and anti-speciesism are not interchangeable, but that's a whole other discussion for another day. So what does it mean to be anti-specious? And I believe Ayanna Goodfellow summarizes it very well in their book called Radical Companionship. Anti-speciesism is actively rejecting the ideology of human supremacy, the interpersonal violence of ownership-based human-to-animal relationships, and the institutional deliberate colonization, degradation, and exploitation of non-human animals. It is for these reasons why I believe it's very important that Funa Bomsini, and I extend this to everyone, remains consistently anti-oppression. We all know and have heard time and time again that no one is free until all of us are free. This simple statement acknowledges the intertwinement of various forms of oppression and that you cannot detangle one completely without detangling the others. However, time and time again, individuals who are different species to us are left out of the equation. So are we truly being consistently anti-oppression? As Emma Harkinson puts it simply, we cannot be against violence sometimes or against injustice sometimes. Oppression is a structure, and we must work to recognize it in all its forms so we can act and dismantle it accordingly. So as you can see, serving vegan food is more than just serving vegan food. It is a simple but important act of remaining defiant and consistent in our anti-oppression. I'll now pass it over to Joe, who will give us a rundown of Funa Bom's global history.
Thanks, Izzy.
Nice
work. Before I begin, I should note that some of what I'm about to say I've ripped directly off Margaret Killjoy's amazing podcast called Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff, which has a series on food, not bombs, which I highly recommend listening to. So if you're listening, thanks, Margaret.
Is Killjoy a real name?
Margaret Killjoy?
Yeah.
Who knows?
No, okay.
Yes. Activists. You'll never find out. You'll never get to the bottom of it. Food Not Bombs started as a performance art joke in the 1980s. Some of you may remember that as the decade's protest-style du jour. The joke was a bit bad taste, but the concept has been refined over time, so the joke got better. To paint the scene, it was Cambridge, Massachusetts in the early 80s. The Cold War arms race was cranking full throttle. The Reagan administration had just done unprecedented work to undermine social security in the name of labor market liberalization. Homelessness was on the rise. The Federal Reserve's Paul Volcker had just addressed high inflation by hiking interest rates to crunch wages, all the while military spending was soaring. If that situation sounds familiar, it's because we're getting pretty close to Australia's exact economic policy calibration at the moment. But I digress. So back to Cambridge, a group of activists noted millions was being spent on a nuclear armaments facility, so that was Draper Labs, while over the other side of the road, people were sleeping on the street and going hungry. To protest the absurdity of accelerating military spending in an environment of social austerity and deflationary monetary policy, they decided to run a soup kitchen outside the nuclear laboratory. So far, so good. Like, feeding people is always a great thing to do. The bad taste part of the joke was that the activists themselves decided to dress up like homeless people and participate in the public feasts. To their credit, they did invite some people from the homeless shelter down the road to help cook and eat as well. But in spite of the kind of like class blackface of dressing up like the poors, the community feedback from the feast was very positive. And that's because the activists had addressed a real and systemic problem in their community in a very direct way. The results were immediate and tangible. For that night, people were fed who were otherwise going to go hungry. So many of the activists quit their jobs and began feeding their communities full time, delivering food to shelters, old folks' homes, protests, halfway houses, all of that kind of stuff. The food was sourced from all over the place, donations from shops who would have otherwise thrown it out, restaurants, public gardens, household leftovers, dumpsters. In developed countries, hungry is never really an issue of food quantity, but legal access. If you're willing to bend some of the laws that prevent people from accessing food, everyone gets fed. The leftover food they cooked would be served in a park to anyone who wanted it. These serves became informal public parties for all walks of life. On a public wall in the park in Cambridge, Sunflower Child had graffitied "Money for Food, Not Bombs," and Thus, the concept of Food Not Bombs was born. And from there, some of the activists moved to other cities, moved countries, and began their own chapters, and the concept spread globally. Free vegan food to anyone who wants it, served in support of non-violence and alleviating poverty. So, since the 80s, Food Not Bombs has become a staple of pretty much every major protest movement in the developed world. So, in the late 90s, there were protests against globalization and predatory free trade agreements, which forced exploitative labor practices in developing nations under the threat of violence. And these were fed by Food Not Bombs. In the early 2000s, the protests against the US unfolding war crimes in Iraq were fed by Food Not Bombs. In the late 2000s, the Occupy movements protesting the finance sector's ravaging of public funds, while vast swaths of the economy lost their jobs and homes, were fed by Food Not Bombs. 2010s, the climate strikes, protesting the continued impunity and life-threatening environmental destruction of the fossil fuel industry, was fed by Food Not Bombs. In the early 2020s, the Black Lives Matter protests against systemic racism, police militarization, and the emerging fascism of right-wing populist governments were fed by Food Not Bombs. And in Sydney 2024, the protests against state funding of an unambiguous genocide unfolding in Gaza were also fed by Food Not Bombs. You will also find Food Not Bombs at Newtown Station every Thursday and Sunday, feeding people as captains of government, industry, and housing markets continue to fail addressing a systemic housing and cost of living crisis. So now I'm just going to get into a bit of some of the history of state oppression of Food Not Bombs. So the goal of Food Not Bombs is ultimately nothing more than to feed people for free. This on its face seems like a harmless and unambiguous moral good that shouldn't attract state repression, yet on many occasions it has. I should note that we're very lucky in the Sydney chapter that Food Not Bombs has not attracted the attention of local law enforcement, and they seem to be okay with us sitting at tables and giving out food at Newtown Station. We're pretty much left alone, and we love this, and would like to keep that relationship with police. But political environments and laws around public gatherings can change very quickly. If the state were motivated, I'm sure a swarm of permitting, public order, and safety laws could be mobilized against us to impede or even criminalize our operations. It's for this reason we prefer to stay decentralized, spontaneous, and anonymous. We do not publicly name our donors, our sources of food, our members, or the people we feed. And that is purely because politics can change. What was welcomed one day can be criminalized the next, and this has happened in many places globally. For example, in the US, Food Not Bombs has spent a long time on the FBI's domestic terror watch list. This may rightfully strike you as absurd. How does providing open access food constitute terrorism? An insight into the FBI's logic can be gleaned from their repression of the Black Panther movement. So, one of the activities that the Black Panthers were involved in was to provide free breakfasts to children in disadvantaged and largely black neighborhoods. The school breakfast program was described by the FBI as one of the most dangerous things the Black Panthers ever did. Because not only did it garner massive public support for them, but it actively highlighted the paucity and cruelty of the economic and state structures that surrounded those communities. Without the Panthers, these kids would have gone to school hungry. And just a heads up, if I can digress for a bit, a 2019 study prior to the cost of living crisis suggested that 1 in 5 Australian children were going to school without breakfast and 15% without lunch. This was before the cost of living crisis, so you can assume it's worse now. The Smith family has noted that the shame and humiliation associated with being too poor to bring lunch to school is a significant driver of school truancy. Because parents and kids are ashamed to go to school without lunch. And that is responsible for diverging educational income outcomes along the income spectrum. And if that doesn't horrify you, I don't know what will. But anyway, back to the Panthers. It was also, what the breakfast program did was also underscore how easy it was with a little organizing for a community to reconfigure an urban environment to serve everyone rather than the needs of a few. Local communities could provide services which the state could not or refuse to. And if local communities could feed themselves and house themselves and protect themselves, why have a state at all? Communities feeding themselves were seen as fundamentally corrosive to reliance upon and allegiance to the state. Whether that be state welfare or the capitalist economy, which was facilitated through state enforcement of property law and markets. Furthermore, the organisational and logistical skills crafted through catering to large numbers of people were viewed as having the potential to support more militant forms of resistance. In the words of Napoleon, an army marches on its stomach. The Ukrainian war has demonstrated time and time again that if food supply chains are broken, the entire Russian war machine comes to a crushing halt. In response to the FBI's fears of militancy among our members, I would remind them that a whole two-thirds of our organization's name is not bombs. The Food Not Bombs cookbook teaches you how to make a mean stir-fry, not homemade napalm. We're really just here to feed people. Okay, so how does spooking the authorities manifest on the ground? Well, often by members getting arrested for fucky little public safety laws that would rather see people go hungry than, I don't know, like a curry being spilt on the ground or a local business owner being mildly upset that they had to look at a poor person. So an example of this was in San Francisco. So in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a mayor called Art Agnos who was elected on a supposedly super progressive ticket of feminism, environmentalism, poverty relief, and pro-unionism, but ended up actively serving gentrification. And there are many such cases. This I will bite my tongue about saying anything about the city of Sydney. Anyway, Food Not Bombs had set up in Golden Gate Park and had initially had a permit to serve there. But soon local businesses complained about having homeless people eat in public view of their businesses, and so the permit got revoked. And so did Food Not Bombs pack up and go home? No, they kept serving people anyway. And so, because they were serving people anyway, the cops started systematically arresting them, with hundreds of arrests made in the first month. Apparently it became a bit like a conveyor belt, where someone would line up for a free meal, a volunteer would put it on a plate for them, then that volunteer would get arrested, there would be another volunteer standing behind them to come and serve the next person, and it'd just go into a conveyor belt until all the paddy wagons were filled. Over the next 7 years, over 1,000 people got cited and arrested for participating in Food Not Bombs like this. Naturally causing a bit of a public furor, because arresting people for feeding the homeless is just some like real stormtrooper level evil shit to do. Eventually something that helped stop this was the National Lawyer Guild turning out to serve people. Naturally San Francisco cops were not keen on arresting lawyers, and so they started to leave Food Not Bombs alone. Anyhow, Food Not Bombs San Francisco continues to operate to this day, but still has to persist through regular police sweeps of homeless encampments. I'm hoping that through our efforts, and the efforts of anyone listening to this, that we can avoid the criminalisation of homelessness and community-based support services that the US has seen. But, you know, it happens. So, if you're a lawyer, this is a formal call-out to let us know. We're totally cool at the moment, but who knows what the hell will happen to public gathering laws under a Dutton government. So let us know that you exist and that you're awesome if you do have a law degree. And if you think it's been hard to run Food Not Bombs in the US, try doing it under more repressive regimes. The Minsk chapter of Food Not Bombs in Belarus, for example, has volunteers that have been imprisoned for up to 5 years now for activities related to Food Not Bombs. Things can get bad, even when you're just trying to feed people. Luckily, the history of Food Not Bombs has not been nearly so dramatic. It's a rather cute tale of people doing good things, largely unimpeded. So I'll hand it over to Izzy, who will take us through the history of Food Not Bomb City.
So the history that we do know of, which isn't much, of Food Not Bomb City has been accumulated over many hours of research by one of our fellow comrades called Ezra. The earliest records go back to September 2003, where Food Not Bomb's banner appears on a Sydney Reclaim the Streets event page. From there, it seems based on a Food Not Bomb's blog and forum that Food Not Bomb's was most active from September 2007 to November 2008, and a huge chunk of what happens after 2008 is missing, assuming there was a chapter or chapters operating during this time. Finot Bom Sini reappears online in 2014, but we don't know when it actually began or when it ended. So everything's all pretty vague, unfortunately. The Finot Bom Sini today began at least in 2020. As mentioned earlier in this talk, Finot Boms continued to operate during the pandemic, and once it was safe to do so, began to serve in person again. From my experience, when I joined around mid 2022, Finot Bom Sini operated almost the exact same way that we do now, just with some differences, like cooks always happen at a volunteer's house, as opposed to now one of the 2 days when we cook happens at Addison Road Community Centre, which is awesome. It also was just on a random day, as it depended on when volunteers were available. Now we have more, it happens on the same days every week, which is helpful for people to know when to come, especially those who don't have social media, and other various things. So over the last 2 years, we've been fortunate to have not only the number of volunteers grow, but the amount of food rescued and donated too, meaning we have gone from one meal to up to 4 meals, making more per serve, which is really cool. We started off with like one small table and a pot, and now we have 2 large tables, and sometimes that's not even enough. And we joke it would be really cool to one day just be able to line up throughout on the entire Newtown station. we also have connections with local businesses who give us leftover food instead of throwing it out. We have 2 awesome zines now and have been involved in various actions and events. Finot Bom has become a place where people from all walks of life can come, eat yummy, free vegan food, and just chat with lovely humans. Truthfully, other than the food, I think that the chats are one of the best parts of Finot Bom. I feel lucky to be part of such an amazing, radical community, and it's been so lovely to watch Finot Bom become what it is today. I am excited to see it grow and change to whatever is needed by the community, and it would be awesome if you could be part of that too. So, how does one even begin a Finot Bom chapter? First and foremost, it's important to emphasize that Finot Bom can take various forms, and it most certainly doesn't have to look the same. So Finot Bom can be 1 or 2 people just cooking up a meal and serving it out to people who live near them or whatever's convenient. Or it could be a dozen or more person operation that gives away multiple meals and heaps of produce. Each end of the spectrum involves main roles to make it happen. And this includes, first and foremost, the most obvious one, which is food. Most of Finot Bom Sini's food is donated by local businesses and organizations who are going to throw it away. Members can also, or do also contribute. If you're willing to adopt a not necessarily illegal, but slightly flexible attitude to the law, you can also find absolutely insane amounts of fresh and edible produce in many dumpsters. Again, what keeps people from accessing food is not that the food supply, but property laws. So being a little flexible with respect to the law can be helpful sometimes. Sini is lucky though in that our donation volumes are huge, so shout out to our donors. Yes. Next thing is cooking the food. So to cook up a meal or two, you would ideally want a kitchen. Finot Bom Sini has been fortunate to have Addison Road Community Centre provide theirs, as I mentioned earlier. You can also always try to find something similar near you. I'm sure there's many other community spaces that have kitchens that can be used. On Sundays, we do have to rely on volunteers to offer their kitchen for the day. Another option is a portable burners, and just cook wherever you can with that. Maybe even cook where you serve, so you can just serve it straight from the pot. And worst case scenario, if you are unable to cook the food, which sometimes happens with us, you can just give away the produce that you have, or keep anything that might last for the next week, for the next cook and serve. Another very important role is transport. If you are operating like us and don't store diced food nor serve in the same place that you cook, you will need at least 1 vehicle to help transport food to cook, and then everything from cook to serve. I would even add then everything back to someone's house or to a storage box. Yeah, there's lots of driving around. But last but most certainly not least, servers. So I would argue that this is optional, especially since here in Sydney we are starting to see regulars, so people coming to serve, just serve themselves more and more often. There has been discussions around what is best, like to serve or to let people just serve themselves, but there's been no final decision that's been made. Regardless, you do what works for you and your fellow comrades. Other essential equipment would be like pots and or containers to transport the food in, serving spoons and other utensils, takeaway containers and cutlery. It's also ideal to have zines, flyers and anything else you can think of that helps people stay informed, radicalized, or just learn some cool stuff about different spaces that are happening in the community. Bonus equipment includes banners, posters, and if possible, other free stuff, like you can give away clothes, beverages, toys, whatever you can think of. But at the end of the day, each collective has full autonomy over how they wish to operate, which is one of the beautiful and fun things about FinoBombs. So I'll now hand it over to Joe, who will go into how you can help out our very own Sydney chapter.
Yeah. So yeah, that rundown was for the internet. I suspect most people are kind of like living in the area here, in which case, great, you can help us out. There's already a FinoBombs chapter happening. Unless you want to do one out west, that would be awesome if someone could help serving out there. Anyway, there are heaps of ways you can help us out. One of our primary bottlenecks at the moment is that many of our members are quite young, so don't have cars. And as Izzy gave some stats on before, most people, so over 50% of people aged from 18 to 35, are having difficulty paying for food sometimes, let alone maintaining the costs of a car. So if you have a car and a free Thursdays or Sundays, do hit us up. We'll get you on our crypto chat organizing business, and you'll get to meet some very lovely and occasionally very strange people. If you have a van, you'll officially become our best friend. If you have a large kitchen that can accommodate around 5 people, that's also amazing. We'll bring over the ingredients for the people. The cooks generally last from about 2 to 5 o'clock, so that's a good 3 hours of getting to know some interesting folk before we clean up and haul out. And we will leave your kitchen clean, by the way. If you run a restaurant, a cafe, a grocery store, or a garden, amazing. Give us anything you're going to throw out. We'll make good use of it. And if you want to come serve up in Newtown Station and make friends in strange places, do come along. If you have a community you'd like to serve at a different location or day and would like to start organizing, hell yeah. Let us know and we'll start pitching in. If you're a lawyer, incredible, we'll keep you on standby and hopefully never need you. If you want to shoot us money, that's always useful, as we haven't figured out how to source free containers yet. We also probably need to build a shed at some stage, so we'll need materials for that. And most importantly, if you're ever hungry, come find us. We're always posting on the socials, so Facebook, Instagram, and Mastodon in the future, as mentioned earlier. And we're probably going to keep avoiding Twitter or Zitter. So yeah, don't look for us there. No one likes Elon and food dog bombs. Anyway, summarize, helping out feels good, making friends feels good, being cool feels good, community is delicious. Any questions?
Thank you. Yay.
Yeah, like you must generate a lot of organic waste even then, what do you do with that?
So at the moment in Annie Road Kitchen, so like without, you know, pumpkin rinds and things like that, they've got giant compost bins. So we put it in that. Yeah, it makes dirt and that makes more food. Hang on.
I'll just say that the churches, you know, Vinnie's and the Anglican Church and the Uniting Church, the Loaves and Fishes and that, they of course have meals all the time for the down and outs, you see.
Mm.
And of course they have no trouble with the police.
Mm.
Why don't you sort of support them and you know, instead of and providing food for them so that they can expand?
Mm.
Mm?
So they actually support us. So some of our donors are churches, and they don't always have the staff or the room to cater to all the people who are hungry, just because the problem is so severe. So we kind of like take a flexible approach where we take the food that they couldn't cook because they get donated a lot of food from out the back of Woolies and that kind of stuff. We take it and cook it up and serve it. And just to be clear, we haven't had any troubles with the police yet, but that does happen.
And just to that point, so when I was homeless and eating out soup kitchens and whatnot, I was just served food, you know. But it wasn't until I encountered Food Not Bombs that I was given self-reliance. So I was taken out on dumpster diving trips and I was taught how to dumpster dive and find my own food, you know. And even being involved in the cooking, I learned how to cook it, you know, making Vegemite on toast up until that point, you know. So I really benefited in three different ways from my involvement in Food Not Bombs. I became more self-reliant. I didn't feel like I was just begging at the door for food like I was at the churches, you know. I was actually part of the process as well, not just the end user sort of thing, you know. And so that was beneficial. And I got a community, which was so important to me. For homeless people turning up to the kitchen, you know, when I was in those places, there is a community. Some people connect, you know, as patrons there, but for a lot of the time you eat, you go back to wherever you're sleeping sort of stuff. It's a different thing, but when you're actually involved in the whole process, you do get connected to people, so I really enjoyed that. And the other thing I've got to admit, coming from a pretty limited background, is I got an education about politics, which was actually really beneficial. So I changed a lot of my terrible attitudes through my involvement in Food Not Bombs and the people that I encountered there who challenged my views. So there was a lot of very striking difference to what was going on with the other charities, to what's happening with Food Not Bombs. That's just a comment, really. I do have a question for you, though.
Yeah.
So
that was an amazing story,
yeah.
By the way. I think you captured a lot of concept better than we could. So.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Yeah, it's from the heart. I mean,
yeah.
It, you know. So this might be news that we've got a few of the Humanist Society of New South Wales who own this building. We've got some of their committee members in the room right now, of which I'm one. And
Hi, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're so pleased you came. And that was an awesome presentation, far exceeding what I was expecting. It was amazing. Well done. But this might come as news to a couple of the committee members, but four of us recently discussed you guys. And the idea was proposed that we make the hall available for you to either cook in or serve in on a weeknight. Weekends we have bookings and such things, but throughout the week, and I understand you serve on Thursday night, which could be a great night in here, hey. And we have all these trestle tables that can be pulled out.
Sick.
We have a small kitchen, but you don't have to respond now. But we observe all the council regulations, we have fire safety inspections, we're insured, the police can't touch us. So it'll just be somewhere that is a reliable space. But we're thinking not just to cook up, but you could actually have an out of the weather place to serve in as well. You know, we'd even put up in our billboard out front, you know, meal nights, Thursday night at this time, you know, and so people would actually know to come here. So just please know that that's something for you guys to consider. I guess I could form it as a question now. Would it be something you'd be interested in? But maybe get back to us.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely something we'd be interested in. As I said, consensus decision-making, big part of Food Not Bombs. So
yeah,
we'd have to spray it out into the crypto chat of